Well, we're going to switch from worms to mushrooms and talk about the wild and wonderful world of mushrooms, mushroom picking, mushroom eating, and the many uses for mushrooms in medicine and culture and even spiritual practices. Eugenia Bone writes for a variety of publications about food, including Sever, Food and Wine, and the New York Times. She also blogs about preserving foods at DenverPost.com. Her most recent book is Mycophilia, Revelations from the Weird World of Mushrooms. And Eugenia, we're so happy to have you with us today. Thanks for joining us.
Well, thank you for having me.
So let's start by with a basic definition of mushroom. And certainly from reading your book, I know that that's actually not the easiest question to answer because that definition has changed a lot over the years and seems like it's still kind of a dynamic topic. But what are we talking about when we say mushroom?
Well, a mushroom is the fruiting body of a fungus. It is the organ of sexual reproduction, like a fruit or a flower. Not all fungi produce mushrooms. Lots of them don't. But the mushrooms that we find in the forest or that you buy in the grocery store, those are the fruiting bodies of edible fungi.
And fungi are not only all around us, but they're even inside us, too.
Yes. Fungi are everywhere. They're one of the three complex kingdoms of life on planet Earth. They vary from single-celled organisms like yeasts to incredibly gigantic organisms. In fact, the largest living thing is a fungus.
And tell us about that. Isn't it called the humongous fungus?
Yes, that's its nickname. It's this gigantic underground network of string-like cells. That's what a lot of these complex fungi are like. And it grows underground, and it's covering the top of a mountain in Oregon. And it's 2,200 acres square.
That's enormous.
It's gigantic, and it produces fruiting bodies. It produces actually an edible mushroom known as the honey mushroom.
Mm-hmm.
And it's been growing for anywhere from 2,000 to 7,000 years. People aren't really sure of its age, and it's still growing.
Wow. And is that area protected in some way to make sure that nothing happens to the humongous fungus?
No. Well, it's in a national forest.
Okay.
So, and to the extent that all the critters in the forest are protected.
Mm-hmm.
But it hasn't been sort of designated or anything like that.
Any kind of a landmark, a mushroom landmark.
You can't really see it. You can only see it's the result of its being there by the destruction it does, because that type of fungus actually kills trees.
Mm.
And so you can see all this sort of dead tree matter from the sky. And it's almost like a burnt kind of looking shape, and you can see it from planes.
Now, I want to go back to the comment about how many species of mushrooms there are. I was amazed to learn in your book that there are over 1.5 million species of mushrooms, second only to insects.
Yes, that's right. But only 5% have been identified.
And so how do they know the other 95% are out there?
Well, it's extrapolation,
okay.
Basically, because it turns out that a lot of fungi are, every single plant, every leaf, every stem has got fungi living between its cells.
Wow.
Plants and fungi became terrestrial together.
Hmm.
So if you think about that, and many of those plants have multiple different types of fungi living in between their cells. So I think that's one of the ways that big number was achieved. Yeah.
Well, and it really, it had never struck me before how inherently symbiotic mushrooms are until reading your book. And that, you know, I think there are a lot of us that know that certain types of mushrooms, especially, you know, some that we might enjoy eating, tend to grow near this kind of tree or that kind of tree. But it goes much beyond that, that there is this really deeply symbiotic relationship between mushrooms and the ecosystem that they're a part of.
Absolutely. A very profound and evolutionary long relationship. There's basically there's a few different types, you know, of lifestyles that mushrooms have, but one is their role as the decayers of all organic matter on the planet. Mm-hmm. Without them, we'd be buried under miles of plant debris. And the other role is as kind of like the tummy of trees and plants. The fungi will help the tree get nutrients and water from the soil. And a tree without its fungal symbiont living on on its roots will eventually die of malnutrition.
Mm. And I think there's also a third type of lifestyle. Is that right?
Yes, there's parasites. There's pathogens, those fungi that basically take out critters. And those type of mushrooms or those type of fungi produce a lot of very interesting medicines.
Hmm. And I definitely want to talk about that, but I want to take a moment to invite our listeners to call in and join the conversation. We're talking with Eugenia Bone, who wrote Mycophilia, Revelations from the Weird World of Mushrooms. Are you a mushroom lover? Do you tromp around the woods to find them and guard your special locations like a national secret? What fascinates you about mushrooms? Give us a call at 1-800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also email us at talk@wpr.org. Or I would encourage you to post mushroom photos on our Facebook page. That's The Larry Mealer Show. M-E-I-L-L-E-R is how you spell Mealer. And you don't need to be a member of Facebook to view the photos. And actually, William has posted several photos, including an enormous puffball that he put a Green Bay Packers cap on to show how big it is, and a couple other really great hen in the wood type mushrooms, just some really some great photos there. So take a look at those and post your own. We would love to see them. So I think that going along with that, those symbiotic relationships that we were talking about, that's what makes some mushrooms pretty near impossible to cultivate, right?
That's absolutely right. In fact, some of our most cherished edibles are what they call mycorrhizal, meaning they are symbiotic with living trees. So in order to grow, say, a chanterelle or a truffle or a porcini mushroom, you'd have to put in an orchard, and hopefully all the rest of the environmental factors that go into the production of the fruiting
mm-hmm.
body.
And then make sure the spores get there and hope that they
well,
take up residence.
It's pretty easy to inoculate a tree with mushroom spore. It's just very hard to get that fungal spore. It's easy to get it to grow on the tree roots and all that, but what's hard is to get it to fruit. Because there can be all sort of factors that that we just don't even know about. I mean, there could be bacteria that need to be present or certain minerals and pH of the soil, all kinds of factors. It's like creating an ecosystem.
Mm-hmm.
It's sort of like the difference between having to do a saltwater fish tank and a freshwater.
Right.
The saltwater one is very complex.
Right, right. Yeah, really. I mean, there really is a true science to it. And, you know, going back to the fact that you can't, even if you've been fortunate to find a particular kind of mushroom in a particular place for several years, you can't necessarily count on the fact that they're going to be there that next time that you go because conditions might be different and things like that. And I think that must lend to the euphoria of finding those wild mushrooms, right? That you can't count on it, and you really can't control it.
Absolutely, and it is such a rush to to come on a big blossoming of mushrooms, but they don't come up on a regular basis, or unless the conditions are right, because the fungus that lives below ground, it doesn't have to always fruit.
Mm-hmm.
It continues to live for year after year after year. So it's sort of like, you know, if the fungus is like the apple tree and the mushroom is like the apple,
mm-hmm.
well, you know, the apple tree can continue to grow even if it doesn't produce an apple.
Right.
It just won't diversify and it won't, you won't get new trees coming
mm-hmm.
up. So it's the same, that's the analogy that most mycologists use.
Well, and I want to definitely talk about those forays that you've been on, but I want to go to David in South Milwaukee who has a question. Hi, David.
Hi, I'm calling about the common mushrooms one gets in the food store and produce section. They're white, and the kind that I picked up indicate that they're pre-washed and ready pre-washed and ready, I guess they just call it. Do I need to wash those before I eat them?
You really don't. I mean, you can, but they're just because some growers use pesticides, but that is really going out of fashion. Less and less that happens. But the soil is that they grow in, the compost is sort of self-sterilizing. It has to get to a certain temperature before they inoculate it with the mushroom spore spawn, they call it. So you're really okay. Just brush off the dirt. But that something about the white mushroom you might find interesting is it's called an Agaricus bisporus, and that's the same mushroom as the cremini, the little brown one. They're the same species.
Huh.
They're just selected for whiteness and one is not. And the portobello is also the same species. It's just a non-selected for whiteness, like a cremini, allowed to grow to full maturity.
And I found it really interesting and somewhat embarrassing when I read that in your book and that you say that, you know, if you do like a completely blind taste test, that the flavor between a white button mushroom and a cremini is almost impossible to detect a difference. And I have to say, before I read that, I would have sworn that the creminis tasted better.
Well, I think that's
marketing at its best.
Yeah, kind of. There is a difference, though, between a wild Agaricus bisporus flavor and a cultivated one.
Mm.
Because the wild one is, it has a whole soup of microbial action in the wild environment. And it's sort of like the wine grape will reflect what's in the soil.
Mm-hmm.
Likewise, a wild mushroom tends to reflect more of what's in what's in the soil that it grows in than in a cultivated scenario.
It's the French concept of terroir.
Exactly. And it applies to mushrooms, which to me was just kind of awesome.
and there's so much more to talk about mushrooms with Eugenia Bone, and we are going to definitely do that. Eugenia Bone writes about food for a variety of publications, including Sever, Food and Wine, and the New York Times. She also blogs about preserving food at denverpost.com, and her most recent book is Mycophilia, Revelations from the Weird World of Mushrooms. Thanks for joining us today on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson, sitting in for Larry Mueller and talking about mushrooms with author Eugenia Bone. She has most recently written Mycophilia, Revelations from the Weird World of Mushrooms. And Eugenia, thanks so much for staying with us and for sharing your, I think passion is not too strong a word, your passion for mushrooms.
That's right. Thank you.
Well, we are fortunate here in Wisconsin to have morels, and morels come up over and over in your book. What is it about those mushrooms that throw people into a frenzy to find them?
Well, it's sort of a mystery, but I have a few ideas, and I talked to a few people about it to try to figure that out. But I think one is, of course, the flavor is superlative. They taste delicious. They're also quite difficult to find, which makes them exciting to hunt. And they're unpredictable. They grow in a variety of ways. In fact, when we were talking earlier about the difference between saprophytes, you know, mushrooms that decay, and those that live in symbionts of trees, well, morels seem to do both. In fact, they'll grow out of cracks in your wall if they want. It's also a very popular American pastime, since they're widespread in temperate forests all across the country.
And, of course, truffles are in a class by themselves. Tell us about them. What makes them so sought after, and how are they hunted?
Well, truffles are, there are a lot of different kinds of truffles, but the ones that we really like to eat are a few different species. But all truffles are mushrooms that fruit underground. It's maybe an evolutionary strategy that made them avoid fires or weather issues, or whatever. So they eventually started. In fact, they're related to the morel, and they kind of became smaller and smaller and rounded, and they rolled underground. So then the mushroom was dealing with the problem of how to spread its spores. So the truffle, it emits these pheromones that attract mammals to dig them up. And in the digging, they their spores are spread about and can start new fungi elsewhere. So the ones that we love, the paragord and the white truffle, those emit pheromones that attract swine.
Mm-hmm. And I was going to say, in France, it's generally pigs that are used to dig truffles.
Yes, and what attracts the swine also attracts us. So the flavor of a truffle, of these truffles that we love to eat so much, are the flavor is in this off gas that they produce to attract the animal, which is why when you get a truffle, it's a good thing to eat it right away, because it only off gases for a few days, 4 days
on
the average. You can't, people try to capture that aroma in eggs or in flour and rice and butter, but it's very hard to do. It's a volatile gas that disappears into the air and leaves the truffle as this kind of non-tasting, like much clod of fungal matter.
Wow. So. And if I remember correctly, you have a story of someone buying a truffle at auction for an outrageous amount of money and keeping it too long and it really turning into nothing. And so he turned around and bought more really expensive truffles.
Yes, which I hope he had the good sense to eat.
Yeah,
right,
you'd think, yeah. Wow. Well, and truffles certainly just evoke this idea of luxury and you know, really that hedonism, I think, that mushrooms kind of bring out in us anyway.
Yes. Well, they're very hard to find because we can't find them. We can't smell them. So you do need to hunt them with an animal. And they can be grown, and they are grown. In fact, in the United States, there's numerous truffle orchards that are producing the paragord, the black truffle. The white truffle has been unsuccessful. Nobody's been able to grow it in an orchard situation at all, maybe because it needs like a bacteria or something in order to fruit. But so they're worth orcharding because they're so remunerative. You know, you can make so much money on them. You can't really make enough money off of a chanterelle to put in a whole orchard, but a truffle, yes. And I think it's those pheromones, that wonderful earth. I mean, it reaches people on a very like lizard brain level, you know, and that's what makes them so sexy and so delicious to eat. But if you cook them, they lose their flavor too. So that's why we usually eat them raw.
Interesting. And often just like a little shaving on top of something,
yes,
right?
Nano shavings. Huge amounts of money.
Yeah. So John in Green Bay asked a question that fits in here. Is it true that truffles are grown on hazelnut bushes and roots?
Yes, the paragord truffle is mycorrhizal, or is a symbiont of a variety of trees, and one is the hazelnut. Mm. And the orchards in North Carolina, for example, are hazelnuts.
Mm.
But they also grow on other trees. And the white truffle in Italy grows on scrubby willow. It's kind of all over, yeah.
Well, if you have a question for Eugenia Bone about mushrooms and mycophilia, you can join in by calling 1-800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also email us at talk@wpr.org or post a comment, question, or a photo on our Facebook page, The Larry Mueller Show. And we do have a question here. Carl in Madison would like to join in. Hi, Carl.
Howdy. Eugenia, I've had only one experience with dried shiitake mushrooms, but I was wondering, and this is a vague question, but what can you tell us about dried mushrooms? The shiitakes certainly enhance the flavor of some soups and stews that I was brewing up. And I understand it's due to something called nucleotides that they're chock full of after they're dried. What can you tell us about their use and their flavor benefits?
Great. Thanks, Carl.
Many mushrooms dry beautifully, and in some cases, the flavor is intensified by drying. So a porcini mushroom, for example, is wonderful fresh. When dried, it is a power pack, and you can even grind up and make a powder out of those dried porcini and flavor butter with it, for example, and it's just extremely, you know, strong and savory and tasty. And
I've had steak rubbed with porcini salt. That was amazing.
Fabulous, right? Other mushrooms will actually, it'll accentuate the tastes in ways that are unusual. For example, the candy cap mushroom, which is a little brown mushroom that grows in Northern California, when it's fresh, it has applications, savory applications. You know, cook it with chicken or whatever. But when it's dried, the maple flavor of that mushroom becomes so intense that when you rehydrate it with some water and add a little sugar and make a simple syrup, you end up with, it's like maple syrup shaped like a mushroom. And it's used in dessert applications.
Is that the one, too, that you say in the book that when you eat it, you actually exude the scent yourself? It's such a powerful smell.
Yes, it's wonderful. I mean, after you have a dessert with, let's say, baked apples stuffed with dried candy cap mushrooms, after you've eaten it, then, let's say you go to the gym, your sweat will smell like maple syrup. Even your rug making will smell like maple syrup, which, you know, hey, it's just very cool and very unusual.
Well, so Carl was asking about drying mushrooms. David from South Milwaukee emailed. He also was wondering if mushrooms can be frozen, and if so, how?
Yes, they freeze very well, but you do need to heat them first, either sauté them and then freeze them, or boil them briefly and freeze them, and for two reasons. You want to stop the enzymatic action, which ages really all, you know, meats, plants, you know, and fungi. And also it kills any latent bacteria, especially if it's a wild mushroom, you know, that might be there and sometimes can create off flavors. So if you put up, say, raw chanterelles in the freezer, then it's not unlikely for them to have a metallic taste when you cook them up, and that's because of a little bacteria that wasn't completely killed off, but survived the freezing process, even though it was growing very slowly.
Well, I wanted to ask you about some other culinary mushrooms that people rhapsodize about, and Chris in Green Bay actually has a question about that, and about puffballs, so we'll go to him in a minute. But what are some of those other mushrooms that people just go crazy about?
Well, you know, it's funny because there's, depending on how into it you get, people get crazy about some really weird mushrooms. And it also has, there's some regional applications, you know, that some places have mushrooms that are very, where their culinary applications are very meaningful, in heritage ways, in heritage recipes. But the big hitters are going to be the porcini mushrooms, the chanterelle mushrooms, the truffles, the morels, and then from there, for me personally, I mean, I love the hen of the woods mushroom, which is a delicious, woodsy, almost smoky tasting mushroom. Shiitake is delicious. I love the Agaricus bisporus, the little white button mushroom. You just need to cook it with some sensitivity, I think. Mm-hmm. Then there's terrific things like hedgehogs, which are a tooth fungi that here in the East have a kind of apricot-y flavor. Black trumpets, which are very velvety and sort of a goth-looking mushroom, black and ragged, wonderful pickling mushroom. It really, I gotta say, the list goes on and on. There's 100 fine edible mushrooms to be found in temperate forests.
Well, and let's talk to Chris in Green Bay about those puffballs. Hi, Chris.
Hello. Yeah, I found these puffballs in I'm outdoors quite a bit in different areas, and they're, you know, anywhere from a little bigger than a softball to about soccer ball size when I find them, like in late October, November. But I actually found one of my old buildings after a guy moved a bunch of hay and straw that's been there for a long time. And of course, it's totally dark in there. And this one's about the size of a soccer ball.
Wow.
And it was laying there. And of course, I think it's too late to to harvest it, but I think I want to know if I could break it up and spread the spores around within the in that area, and because I don't need it for anything else. So
absolutely,
if I could grow more.
Yes, I'd say have the kids go at it and kick it around like a softball. That'll spread the
there
spores.
You go.
So effectively, and in fact, that's the way puffballs spread their spores, is when they mature, they break open and all those spores fly about. So, yes, you can do that by abuse,
that,
basically.
That's and I mean, really, you're helping the mushroom do what its whole purpose is to do, right?
Absolutely, yes. It's not it's not a delinquent thing to do.
Right. Well, I want to make sure we talk about mushrooms in a more nutritional, medicinal way, too, because for a long time, they were considered a food without much nutritional value, and now they're really considered to be a type of a superfood. And there's also some pretty amazing medical research going on with mushrooms as well. I have to say, I was sick for a good part of last week, and one of the supplements that was highly recommended to me was reishi mushroom capsules. And so mushrooms are really coming into their own in medicinal and other health ways. What are some of the qualities that mushrooms are thought to have?
Well, in terms of their nutritional values, the reason why they had been sort of poo-pooed by the establishment for so long was because they are mostly water. But the 5 to 20% of mushrooms that are not water are terrific nutritionally. They're a great source of protein. Actually, they fall somewhere between beans and meat.
Wow.
They have more protein than beans. You have to eat a lot of mushrooms, though. That's the thing, because there's so much of them are composed of water. But they're very satiating. If you eat a mushroom in place of meat, you'll feel as full as if you ate meat, but you won't get the calories or the saturated fats. Mushrooms have fatty acids, but they're unsaturated.
Hmm.
They also have all kinds of cool vitamins. Mushrooms are the only source of vitamin D that is not, that's not meat, but the meat sources are weird. They're like, you know, sea mammals and stuff like that. So they're a fantastic source of vitamin D, especially mushrooms that have been irradiated or exposed to sunshine.
Hmm.
They're a source of selenium, which is an important mineral,
mm-hmm.
and they are a great source of fiber.
Hmm.
Raw mushrooms are actually not digestible.
Really?
No, they go through your upper GI tract. But then when they get into your colon, they are very good food for the good bacteria in your body. So some scientists are saying they're like a prebiotic.
Wow.
But in order to get the nutritional value out of mushrooms, you have to cook them.
Hmm, that's interesting.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess when I think about it, most ways that we do prepare mushrooms are generally cooked.
Are cooked, yes. Mm-hmm. And if you want to get any nutritional value out of them, you need to cook them. You'll get the fiber from them if they're cooked.
Mm-hmm.
And if they're uncooked or raw, you'll also get the fiber from them, but you won't get the nutritional value.
And what about the medicinal uses? What is it about mushrooms that seem promising, like I said, the reishi mushrooms for immune-boosting potential and things like that?
Well, there's a lot of mystery still in that area, because the use of mushrooms, it predominates in traditional Chinese medicine, and the Western data on mushrooms and their application as medicine is kind of still evolving.
Mm-hmm.
But it's the polysaccharides that are in mushrooms that are the really exciting thing. So in the case of shiitake, reishi, and turkey tail, those are the big three in the Chinese pharmacopoeia.
Mm-hmm.
It's these specific polysaccharides that either enhance immune responses and are potentially tumor busting.
Hmm.
It's kind of vague because the Chinese the Asian studies are not following the same necessarily the same protocols as the West, so the information is kind of disjointed.
Mm-hmm.
However, in Japan and China, people who have undergone surgeries for cancer will be prescribed drugs that are derived from, say, shiitake or turkey tail. The polysaccharides mm-hmm. are used as therapies in conjunction with healing from the surgery because they supposedly suppress the cancer and support the immune system.
So to get those benefits, it's through medication that's derived from those mushrooms. I'm guessing that you wouldn't necessarily get the same effect by just eating, say, a plate of sautéed shiitakes.
Well, yeah, like mushrooms aren't going to be a silver bullet. The thing is, the weird thing is, it's like a difference between approaches in the use between the West and the East. See, we're hearing stuff about the Eastern use of mushrooms, but the truth is that in our medicine we respond to disease, whereas in the Chinese approach or the traditional Chinese approach, they seek to avoid disease. And mushrooms and mushroom extracts and mushroom powders and also the eating of mushrooms is prescribed along with other therapies like acupuncture and other herbs and things as a way of maintaining health, of avoiding disease.
Mm-hmm.
So if you've got a disease and then you take mushrooms, you know, eat mushrooms or take mushroom supplements in order to get rid of that disease, it's not really... There's no basis,
mm-hmm.
you know, there's no sort of historical or scientific data that suggests that's going to work,
mm-hmm.
even though there is anecdotal
right.
stories galore. But it's just two different approaches. It's sort of, I guess, a white versus green medicine
mm-hmm.
kind of approach. However, eating mushrooms, you know, it's very good for you. It should be a part of definitely a vegetarian, vegan diet. But for all of us, they're healthy and potentially, I mean, some of our best drugs come from
mm-hmm.
mushrooms.
And they're delicious.
And they're delicious.
Well,
you know, penicillin is from a fungus.
Right. Well, I want to make sure we get to Mark in Green Bay. He's been waiting a bit, so let's go there. Hi, Mark.
Well, hi. Thanks a lot for the opportunity.
Sure.
Several years ago, I came across a tome by Dr. R. Gordon Vossen. It was called Soma, the Mushroom of Divine Immortality. It was the Amanita muscaria mushroom that you always see in fairy tales, the red with white dots. His contention was that human consciousness came about by ingesting this mushroom. And I was wondering if you know of the work or if you know of any follow-up studies. This was published back in the late 40s, early 50s.
Yes, I know it very well. And there are a lot of, quite a few books that explore the idea of psychotropic mushrooms and their effect on consciousness, spirituality, and so on. And they are I think the Gordon Wasson work is the most persuasive. The psilocybin mushroom has also been explored in a similar fashion. But if you wanted to read further, I suggest you take a look at Food of the Gods, Terence McKenna's book. There's The Sacred Mushroom Seeker, which is essays on the subject. There's books on, there's other books, John Allegro's The Sacred Mushroom and the Cross, which actually just destroyed his career. He was a Dead Sea Scrolls scholar who kind of came to this conclusion that Christianity was based in a mushroom cult. There's a lot of books out there, Mushrooms in Mankind by James Arthur. It's very interesting. It's that's called ethnomycology. There's a lot of good lectures to be heard at the Telluride Mushroom Festival in the last weekend in August every year on that subject. You know, it's cool. It's interesting, but it's, you know, of course, it's speculative. Who knows?
Mm-hmm. Well, unfortunately, the time has just flown by, Eugenia, and we are out of time. Thanks so much for visiting with us today, though.
Thank you. It's been fun.
Eugenia Bone is the author of Mycophilia, Revelations from the Weird World of Mushrooms. And it was a really fun conversation. I hope you'll plan to tune in tomorrow at 11 because I have the privilege of talking with a very special guest. Chef Jacques Pépin has just published a new book, Essential Pépin, more than 700 all-time favorites from my life in food. I hope you'll join us.